Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Michael Neufeldt, Senior Curator in the Space History Department of the National Air and Space Museum, a part of the Smithsonian Institution. The topic of his presentation will be the Apollo 8 mission, as he describes the drama of this historic mission that marked mankind's first journey beyond Earth's orbit in the closing days of 1968, a year filled with otherwise discouraging events such as assassinations, riots, and Vietnam War protests. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 13, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kyle Rubino, president of the OnTrack Guild.
Our guest this evening is Dr. Michael Neufeldt, a museum curator in the Space History Division of the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., a Smithsonian institution. From 2007 to 2011, he served as the division chair. Born and raised in Canada, he has four history degrees, including a Ph.D. from Johns Hopkins University in 1984. Dr. Neufeldt has written three books: The Skilled Metalworkers of Nuremberg in 1989, The Rocket and the Reich in 1995, which won two book awards, and Von Braun in 2007, which has won three awards. He has also been the editor of three other books. He has appeared on numerous television and radio programs, notably on the History Channel, PBS, NPR, BBC, and the German ZDF. And while the subject of Dr. Neufeldt's presentation will be on the dramatic Apollo 8 mission, his appearance tonight comes on the 45th anniversary of another important milestone in American space history, the successful return of the Apollo 9 crew, which was the first to test the lunar module that would eventually put man on the moon. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Neufeldt.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. So thank you very much for the invitation, a chance to visit Omaha, which I haven't had before. So I want to start this by first taking you back to Christmas Eve, 1968.
Yeah. I'll sit on you back on Earth and see what we mean when we say it's a rather foreboding horizon, a rather dark and unappetizing looking place. We're now going over approaching one of our future landing sites selected in this smooth region to call the Sea of Tranquility, smooth in order to make it easy for the initial landing attempt in order to preclude having to dodge mountains. Now you can see the long shadows of the lunar sunrise. We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and divided the light from the darkness.
And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day.
then let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas. And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
That was a transcendent experience, I think, for many people who watch it. How many of you did see that on TV? Yeah, a lot of the audience, including me. It's an extraordinarily memorable moment. That was kind of the height of Apollo 8 and its completely surprise message, because all that NASA told Frank Borman, who was the last to speak, the commander, was do something appropriate. And so he asked around, and that's what they came up with as the right kind of message for a Christmassy TV broadcast. But I need to take you back. Where did this mission come from? In fact, it was completely unplanned in the long term. It was actually put together only 4 months before it was launched in December 1968. As a change in plans for the Apollo program. But to really understand where the Apollo program comes from, we need to go all the way back to the beginning. Of course, many of you know, and some of you experienced, the space race really began with the Sputnik launch in October 1957. The Soviets launched the first satellite. It was a shock that we hadn't done it first. Historians have shown, in fact, the public was probably less perturbed than the media and the politicians. And, of course, the critics of the Eisenhower administration jumped all over this and said, well, how could we be second? How did we make this mistake? It was followed by another Sputnik only a month later, at the beginning of November 57, launching the dog Laika into orbit. And the poor dog actually died in very short order, although the Soviets lied about that. But they had no way to bring the dog back, but it was a satellite that weighed over 1,000 pounds. It was an incredible lifting capacity, and both launches sent the message, yeah, we have an ICBM, and potentially we could launch a nuclear weapon on the United States. So there were many dimensions to this. There was the humiliation aspect, just in terms of coming second. There was the threat that this actually represented, and the national security threat that this represented. The military and space were heavily intertwined, and that was followed at the beginning of December by a humiliation when the first American attempt to launch a satellite, Vanguard, failed miserably. And that Navy project did succeed in the end, but the first satellite was actually launched by the Army, Explorer 1, the end of January 1958. And one of the key people behind it is Wernher von Braun, about whom I wrote a biography. Now, coming out of the space race, Eisenhower and also Lyndon Johnson, who was then Senate Majority Leader, and several others said, we really need a civilian agency to do some of the space program. All space activities as of this time of Sputnik and for some time after were actually done by the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. And there was a lot of competition. There was inter-service rivalry. This was annoying to Eisenhower, it seemed for an international representation of American, at least peaceful dimensions of the space program, that a civilian agency was needed. And so the Democratic majority in Congress, led by Lyndon Johnson and Eisenhower administration, came together and agreed to turn the aeronautics agency, NACA, into NASA, into a much bigger, more ambitious space agency. Aviation is still part of it, NASA, to this day. It's the first A, aeronautics, in NASA, but became a space agency for doing the civilian and peaceful dimensions of space travel. In fact, a military space program continues to this day, and it's not the whole space program, but it in many ways is the public face of the space program. In 1958, the United States did get some satellites into orbit. Things seemed to be going well, at least maybe we weren't as far behind. And then in 1959, the Soviets scored three more spectacular firsts. with the moon. At the very beginning of 1959, after a couple of failed American attempts to get to the moon, one of which did go up to over 70,000 miles, the Soviets flew by the moon. Actually, it turns out they were trying to hit the moon and missed. And then but they didn't tell you that. And it was an amazing accomplishment in itself because it was the first object that launched by human beings that left the gravity field of the Earth and went into deep space, went into orbit around the sun. That was Luna 1. And then in September 1959, they succeeded, not on their second attempt because they actually had several launch failures that they could cover up because of secrecy. But on September 1959, Luna 2 hit the moon, and 1 month later only, they photographed the far side of the moon. And the moon is fixed such that it turns in coordination with its revolution around the Earth so that you only ever see one half of the moon. And the other side was permanently invisible to the human race until we began to send space probes around to photograph the far side of the moon. Well, one of the products of the space race, naturally, was the human space program. And that was pretty clear from the beginning with the launching of a dog. The Soviets maybe had ambitions to put human in space. And it was pretty hard, something Eisenhower very reluctantly conceded. He was a fiscal conservative. He didn't like throwing all this money at a space program. But the public pressure for doing something and trying to catch up and maybe get ahead was too intense. Mercury, as I indicate here, had its basic objectives, put one man in orbit. You understand the medical effects of doing a person in space and what the challenges might be to bringing him back alive. And that was basically its sole objective, was to put somebody in orbit and bring him back alive and understand what happened. And seven astronauts famously were chosen in April 1959, instantly grabbed all the publicity. They were going to be launched on ballistic missiles. What did we have to put somebody in space in those days? You had a ballistic missile, either a shorter range or an ICBM, was the only thing you could do to launch something in orbit at that point. But as I mentioned here at the bottom, for Ike, he wanted that limited program. He wanted to control the growth of the space program and of the missile program as far as he could. He thought it was going to bankrupt the country. He held to a fairly fiscally conservative approach. NASA had plans for space stations, had plans to go to the moon, and Eisenhower said no. And he actually turned Apollo down in the middle of 1960. Of course, that was at the very last year of the Eisenhower administration. So the moon decision comes at the beginning of the Kennedy administration, who was, as I've said here, inaugurated on January the 20th, and barely 2.5 months later, Soviets launched the first human in space, first man in space, Yuri Gagarin, went once around the world on April the 12th, 1961. That, as I show here, is just before the NASA was about to launch an astronaut, as it turned out, Alan Shepard, on a simple suborbital mission, basically only using the smaller Redstone rocket, launch an astronaut up to about 100 miles and fall 300 miles downrange, only about one-third of the velocity needed to get into orbit. To get into orbit, they needed the bigger and more troublesome ICBM Atlas, and the Atlas ICBM was to launch the Mercury astronaut into orbit, which finally happened with John Glenn 10 months later. But to get us back to the immediate decision about Apollo, in the wake of the Gagarin orbit and another great propaganda coup for the Soviet Union, Kennedy said, we need to think about accelerating the space program. Space program is not just about scoring a first. It's about representing American technological capability. It's about influencing third world countries. This was a period in which there was decolonization happening on a rapid scale as Britain, France, Portugal, and others gave up their colonial empires or were forced to give up their colonial empires. Many new countries were coming into existence in the 50s and the early 60s, and there was a sense that in the Cold War struggle between the Soviet Union and the United States, space was a great representational activity. It showed your technological capability, your scientific ability, and it might influence whether a country decided to be capitalist or socialist in its basic economic structure or in its governmental system. So there was considerable pressure on Kennedy now maybe to do something else right after that. 5 days after Gagarin, the CIA launched the Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba. Castro had come into power 2 years before. It was an attempt to use exiles to overthrow the Castro government. It was a disastrous failure. Within a day or so, it was obvious that this was a complete failure and an embarrassment. And the Kennedy administration looked extremely bad. It came in with very favorable press notices because he was so charismatic on TV in comparison to Eisenhower, who seemed stodgy. But now he looked weak and inexperienced, not up to the task. He was only in his early 40s, and this was a new embarrassment. And these two together contribute to Kennedy saying, he actually sent a memo to Lyndon Johnson, who is now vice president, on April the 20th, saying, you know, give me a space program we can win. You know, what is it? Should it be an orbital station? Should it be a man around the moon? Should it be going to the moon and coming back or something else? And so Johnson pulled together a team to find out what they could do. NASA pretty much had the answer, which was go to the moon. My character, Von Braun, was one of those advisors who said, landing on the moon was the one thing that we could do that had a good chance of catching up and passing them. Because it required such a tenfold leap in rocket power that we had the chance to speed up and overtake the Soviet Union in such a moon race. And so the landing on the moon and bringing someone back alive became the policy that Kennedy announced in the picture on the right on May 25th. And there's going to be Johnson as vice president and the Senate chair, and I forgot who the House Speaker is. I'm blanking on his name at the moment. But it occurred 20 days after Alan Shepard. This is the recovery of Alan Shepard's capsule, which is now at the Kennedy Library. The fact that that mission succeeded was important. If it had failed, if it had been an embarrassment, it would have been hard for Kennedy to get up in Congress and ask for $20 billion or more to go to the moon. But it succeeded, and he did go ahead, and Congress pretty much jumped on the bandwagon at that point. The impact on NASA was profound. It changed NASA fundamentally in ways that it still affects its entire structure to this day. As I mentioned here, it's a huge increase, about a quintupling of the budget. It was a $1 billion agency under Eisenhower at the end. It was $5 billion a year, which in today's dollars would have to multiply by at least 8 or 10 to get the inflation factor. So it was 4% of the federal budget, which, as I mentioned here, is 8 times as much as it is now. It's only half of 1% of the federal budget, NASA's budget. So it was a big increase. It was a big commitment. It meant a big infrastructure was needed to build moon rockets, bases, everything else, training centers, and a lot of those facilities are open in the South. So there's significant expansion of the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, called Kennedy after his assassination, at Kennedy Space Center in Alabama, the Marshall Space Flight Center, Louisiana, a factory at Michoud outside New Orleans for rocket construction, Texas. They decided to move the Center for Human Spaceflight, what we now call human space, then called manned spaceflight, to Houston. To set up a new center in Houston. So there's a lot of expansion on the South, which is interesting, is intertwined with the 60s in the sense that Johnson, among others, was among those who felt that the South needed to be reconstructed, that its poverty and backwardness needed to be, the racial segregation and so forth, it needed to be overcome with a major investment in the South. And it certainly was a large part of it, but it was also an industrial mobilization. Over 400,000 workers at its height when Apollo investment about $20 billion program, which is now at least $150 billion in modern dollar terms. 95% of those were contractors, and contractors were everywhere. And I'm sure, although I don't have the data, that Omaha must have been one of those places that had subcontractors working on parts and pieces for Mercury, the follow-on program Gemini, and above all Apollo in this time frame. NASA had to pick a way to go to the moon, and they had to do that in a hell of a hurry to decide how to do that, what size of rocket to build and how to do that. And I will just say here that they decided to do it a certain way, which is to have a separate capsule to go back, a separate spacecraft to go down to the moon and then go back up and rendezvous with a mothership in lunar orbit. That's lunar orbit rendezvous. And they needed to build a giant rocket, Saturn V, which I'll show you in a bit. Now, this is really just a sidebar to my main talk, but this is an interesting set of data that one of my colleagues at the Air and Space Museum produced for a paper years ago. Almost never has the American public been in favor of going to the moon in the majority. The red bar that is opposed is almost always higher than the blue bar in favor of government funding trips to go to the moon. And, of course, the data from the 60s and the early 70s are the most relevant here to Apollo. There is one poll in October 1965 where the favor won out. But there was a lot of skepticism in the country at this huge expenditure for going to the moon, and why are we doing that? It was far from a unitary thing. And one of the interesting political facts about Apollo is it was in considerable trouble in 1963. There was a lot of criticism. There was evidence that the Soviets actually weren't even in the race, which turned out to be true, at least in 1963. And it was faltering a little bit politically. When Kennedy was assassinated, Johnson made it one of Kennedy's legacies that he wanted to fulfill. So that was one of the reasons. It really was, in many ways, a New Deal Democrat program. Goldwater, in 1964, opposed Apollo and said they should give the space program over to the military. So these are interesting sidelights, because you often hear that somehow everyone was in favor of trips to the moon in those days, and we just aren't like that anymore. But there was always skepticism. Well, in the space race, kind of on fast forward here, and just the highlights, but the Soviets scored many firsts in the early and mid-60s still. The first woman in space, 1963. The first unmanned moon landing in 1966. The first walk in space in 65, a few months before. This is the first American walk in space in June 1965. But, you know, the Soviet Union begins to falter in the mid-60s. The U.S. starts to score more firsts. And it reflects a deeper problem with the Soviet program that I'm going to talk about in a minute. Of course, you have the one-man Mercury program, successful mission 61 to 63. 65, 66, we fly the two-man Gemini, and this is from Gemini 4. This spacecraft is in our mall building in D.C. And we launched successful Moon, Mars, and Venus probes. I just put this in as a sidelight. We also had a highly successful, in fact, we always led the Soviet Union in spy satellites, in reconnaissance technology. But that's a secret program and not much visibility to it. Too often the public thinks and still thinks that the human space program of NASA is the space program, which is always bigger and more complicated. But it certainly is the visible part of the program, which is often much, much bigger. However, it is true in the 60s, because of the huge investment of Apollo, this was a time when the NASA program outweighed the military program considerably. Now, I want to give you a sense of the Apollo spacecraft, but also the sense of scale. And I always find this diagram useful. It's actually a NASA drawing from about 65, because the lunar module, those of you who know what a lunar module looks like, you can see the configuration is not exactly the way it turned out a few years later. The details are different. The configuration is basically the same. But you needed a much bigger spacecraft. You needed two spacecraft. One, the command and service modules on the left half, is your mothership in lunar orbit, and you need the lunar module for two of the three astronauts to go down to the moon. So the whole spacecraft weighs near 100,000 pounds. Mercury, the little capsule on the bottom, is only 3,500 pounds, and Gemini about twice that size. And then you look at the outline of the main rockets used here: Atlas for Mercury, Gemini, Titan II ballistic missile for Gemini to the Saturn V. A huge scale up in size was needed in rocket power development. It was a major investment was required to leap from one man in orbit in 1962 to landing on the moon only 7 years later. The challenge that Kennedy set was, before this decade is out, land a man on the moon and return him safely to the Earth. And before this decade out was ambiguous enough that it could be 1969 or it could be 1970, but nobody really wanted to argue for 1970 unless they could get there by 69. So that was the objective. In fact, NASA wanted to get there by 1967 originally because they were afraid that the Soviet Union would try to land on the moon for the 50th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution in November 1967. Now, on the Soviet side, I want to give you briefly a sense of the competition. One of the interesting things about this is that the media reports in 1963 the Soviet Union weren't even in the race was actually true. The Soviets didn't take Apollo very seriously. They were complacent. They were scoring first. They always seemed to be ahead. Was this all a big propaganda show by the United States? They didn't seem to take it very seriously. And it was only around 1963-64 that the space advocates in the Soviet Union, above all, Sergei Pavlovich Korolev, the great chief designer of the Soviet space program, argued politically, we need to go to the moon, we need to land on the moon, the Americans are going to do it, we have to take this seriously. And so, belatedly, in 1964, summer of 64, Khrushchev said yes to having a moon program, and that meant building a giant rocket, and this is actually a picture of that giant rocket being erected in the Soviet way, brought in by rail car, and then put on a giant erector. It is a rocket the size of the Saturn V, but it has certain disadvantages. They didn't have liquid hydrogen technology. Its performance capability was inferior. But it was a huge enterprise. But it was a greatly troubled enterprise. And the Soviet lunar program appears to have been doomed from the start. Because in reality, the Soviets didn't have the money. And the military ran the space program. And they were determined not to be behind the United States in the total number of ballistic missiles. And as far as they were concerned, military developments, military weapons were important. They did not have the depth of the resources of the United States to simultaneously build a gigantic ICBM program and a moon program. And so the moon program kind of faltered. There was infighting between the design bureaus. There was a lack of money. Testing was cut short, and it was very troubled from the start. And there was a second moon program, which was started in the mid-60s, using a smaller booster, which we would say called UR-500, which is better known now as Proton, to send a cosmonaut around the moon, or two cosmonauts around the moon. And the objective was, well, if we can't make the landing on the moon, maybe we can send a cosmonaut around the moon by the 50th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, I have an illustration here, which I stole off the internet, which is somebody drew a comparison of the Soviet moon lander with a lunar module, and it's actually smaller. They could only get one man down to the moon, one cosmonaut down to the moon, if they had succeeded in doing it, because the booster rocket did not have the same efficiency and weightlifting capacity. But this other program actually becomes important to the Apollo 8 story, because the Soviets were trying to have this other idea. Well, maybe we can send a cosmonaut or two around the moon by 67, or at least beat the Americans to doing it. And so they created this circumlunar spacecraft, their code name. They did everything. It was a military program in secret, and everything had number, letter, code name things. And then they named it when they launched it. But they gave it a propaganda name when it was launched with the first cosmonaut. But it basically, those of you who have any look at the space program today, it's a lot like the Soyuz that currently carries astronauts and cosmonauts to the International Space Station, except instead of the spherical orbital module, which would be on the front end, they just have this mechanism for the link to the escape tower on the rocket. But there, in the Soyuz, there is an extra module on the front end, which is extra living space. In order to launch this thing around the moon, they just had to reentry capsule in the middle, and then a kind of propulsion and power in the other module. And the idea was to loop around the moon, and the first successful launch, which I'll come back to again, a partially successful launch, was in 1968. So the 1967 deadline soon went by the boards, again, for lack of money and other internal problems. Now, the beginning of 1967, Apollo took a huge setback, and it was a shock which some of you may well remember. It had the same shock effect as the two shuttle disasters had in terms of, you know, we had launched all these astronauts and nobody ever died. Everything seemed to go pretty well. Some had troubles, but basically everybody came back alive and it was very successful. Suddenly, three astronauts were killed on the launch pad and the first Apollo spacecraft to be launched with a crew, which they wanted to call Apollo 1. Gus Grissom from the Mercury, one of the seven Mercury astronauts in the middle, Ed White, who was actually the man in the suit on that Gemini 4 EVA picture you saw, and Roger Chaffee, who hadn't flown before, were burned and asphyxiated in a launch pad fire on January 27, 1967. And this immediately brought to light that the Apollo spacecraft was really troubled, that there was a lot of things wrong with it. Like any one of these accidents, the same cycle happened with the shuttle. You think, well, maybe they can get it back up in a year, but it took much longer because the problems were more serious. There were problems with inflammability of the spacecraft. There were problems with wiring. There were problems with everything else. And so Apollo was in trouble. Would we make the 1969 or 70 deadline to land on the moon? Would the Russians come first? Was still a credible prospect. Well, just 3 months later, the Soviets launched the first Soyuz spacecraft and the cosmonaut Komarov was killed. Everything went wrong with it in orbit, and then on the way down, his parachutes tangled up and the capsule crashed into the ground. And so the Soviets had a big setback in 1967. So that both space programs are forced into trying to remake themselves. The very end of 1967, Apollo had a great success. The first Saturn V was launched. It was called Apollo 4. There's a long story, which I don't need to bore you with right now, about why they renumbered the program and decided to call the first launch Apollo 4. But the first successful launch of this gigantic rocket seemed to be a sign that the program was coming back. So that brings us to the year in question, 1968. First there was an Apollo 5, which they tested a lunar module in orbit with a robotic program just to test its basic functioning. It seemed to work pretty well. As I mentioned, in March, Zond 4 is the first one of these Soviet circumlunar spacecraft. It wasn't actually launched to the moon, but it was launched to lunar distance and came back. And although the spacecraft was destroyed on reentry, something the Soviets didn't tell anybody, it seemed to be an indication that, yeah, the CIA had already been warning that they were going to loop around the moon, and this was another warning that maybe they were going to do a circumlunar program. On April the 4th, in a coincidence, was the same day that Martin Luther King was assassinated. In the morning, Apollo 6, the second Saturn V, was launched. And it did not go well. There were major problems with the booster. It was so-called pogo effect. It was resonance vibration vibrating massively in part of the launch. Then the engines in the second stage failed. Engine in the third stage failed once it was in orbit. Did not go at all well. And it raised the question, can we put a human on this? Is the next launch of a Saturn V? The plan was the third launch of a Saturn V would have a crew on it. Would that even be possible? And Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama, which is responsible for the booster, went through a very testing program and very quickly demonstrated that it was possible to go put a human on it. But the real question was, you know, what mission to fly on that first? This is a plan that was put together after the fire, and the missions were given letters. So A was the unmanned Apollo 4 and 6. B was the Apollo 5. The first next launch, which would actually be called Apollo 7, of a crew, would come only in the fall of 68. And then there were supposed to be these other tests building up to a lunar landing sometime in 1969. But in August 1968, a key decision was made to do what became the Apollo 8 mission. And the key figures here, that's George Lowe, who's a key decision maker at NASA in Houston, was an unsung hero of the Apollo program. He'd actually been deputy director of Houston, and he took a step down to become the head of the Apollo spacecraft office after the Apollo fire to lead the comeback. The guy in the middle is the head of Houston, Robert Gilruth, another unknown name. Wernher von Braun got all the publicity, and he was the head of Houston. And on the left, Chris Kraft was the head of Mission Control. And in August 1968, Lowe said the lunar module's not going to be ready on time. The Apollo 7 crew is just going to fly the command and service modules in orbit. If everything works out, the next mission should be that D mission, lunar module and command module together in a combined test in orbit, rendezvous docking, full test of both spacecraft. But the lunar module wasn't going to be done on time. And so what could we do? The thought was stirring in his mind, maybe we should just send the command and service modules to the moon, jump ahead on this program, and get some experience of going around the moon. And this actually came together in an extremely short time in the middle of August of 1968. And by the end of the week, on Friday the 9th, the Houston people had convinced themselves that, yeah, this was probably a great idea to try to launch to the moon. And they called up Wernher von Braun, who is on the right is General Sam Phillips, who is an Air Force general, who is the head of the Apollo program. And they all met in Huntsville. They all had their own planes for fast movement and decision making, and they came from Kennedy, they came from Houston, they met up in Huntsville by 2:30 in the afternoon. They decided, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's go to the moon if we can talk the leadership into it, because there's still a couple of people to talk into. And the guy in the middle on the bottom photograph, George Miller, was the head of the human space program at the time, and spaceflight, as they called it. And above him was the administrator of NASA, who I don't have a picture of, Jim Webb, a very, very competent Democrat budget official, and others who became head of NASA under Johnson and Kennedy. Well, they had trouble convincing the NASA leadership that this was too dangerous and too big a leap. And in fact, Webb basically told them, you have to announce Apollo 8 will be in orbit, Earth orbit mission with a lunar orbit possibility. And we'll only decide if the first crew in orbit works to do this thing. The challenge was the software and the trajectory. I mean, we'd only ever been in Earth orbit. We've only ever been a few hundred miles from the Earth. Suddenly you want to go to 240,000 miles from the Earth. That means mission control has to be ready. The trajectory computers have to be ready. Everything has to be ready. You have to shoot at the moon, essentially like leading with a rifle bullet. You have to shoot at where the moon will be 3 days after launch, and you have to pass within maybe 100 miles of the front edge of the moon and swing around it and fire your rocket engine to come into orbit. You had to miss the moon by 100 miles. You couldn't be 100 miles to the right and you smash into it. And you're 100 miles to the left, you won't be in your correct trajectory. So they called this mission C Prime. And they eventually decided to cancel the mission to high Earth orbit, the E mission. And they decided to use the E mission crew, switch the orders of the crews, Borman, Lovell, and Anders. Borman is on their right, was the commander of Gemini 7, key leader after the fire in reforming the spacecraft. Jim Lovell on the left actually had been with him in the Gemini 7 mission, which is 14 days in orbit, a medical mission, really an endurance test, a really difficult endurance test of how long you would need to go to the moon and back was between 8 and 14 days. So you had to prove that humans could be stand the medical effects of 14 days in orbit. So they were on Gemini 7 together. He actually replaced Mike Collins, who ended up becoming the crew member on Apollo 11, the lunar landing. So it seems like Collins couldn't lose. He was either on the first mission to go into orbit around the moon or the first mission to land on the moon. As I mentioned here, Gemini Lovell was actually also Gemini 12 and better known, many people, for being commander of Apollo 13, the mission that failed. Bill Landers was a rookie, hadn't flown before, and he found himself the lunar module pilot, his official title, without a lunar module. And he wasn't as happy that he wasn't going to have a lunar module, but he was given the photography task. The question was there a race? There was a kind of race in the fall of 68, and it was crystallized the beginning of December when Time published this cover, because it seemed like the Soviets were on the verge of sending a cosmonaut, or two cosmonauts, as it turned out, around the moon on the spacecraft, which was got the unmanned version was called Zond for probe. And so Zond 5 at the end of September flew around the moon, and it seemed to be successful, although they actually had trouble, and it re-entered and landed in the Indian Ocean. In the middle of October, Sherraw, Isley, and Cunningham successfully flew Apollo 7, which allowed NASA to say it's going ahead with the Apollo 8 mission. At the end of October, a couple weeks later, they flew Soyuz again after the first time after the Komarov had been killed. Beregovoy successfully rendezvoused with an unmanned Soyuz, but he didn't carry out a docking because he blew it, basically. On Zond 6, the beginning of November, was another Soviet circumlunar trip. And it also had secret failures. But it looked to the West like they really were on the verge of launching a cosmonaut around the moon. And they could tell, and from sources, that the next Soviet launch window would be the beginning of December. And so when Time published this cover, the question was, were the Soviets on the verge of launching a cosmonaut around the moon? Well, actually, in fact, in secret, no. Because they had crews ready to go. One of the crews was headed by Alexei Leonov, who was the first man to walk in space. And they sat on the ground because their Zonds always failed in some way. And they weren't going to launch, they were not crazy enough to launch cosmonauts on that mission when they didn't have a spacecraft that worked. But it seemed like maybe we really were in a race. The Soviets basically faltered. So on December 21st, 1968, the Apollo 8 crew became the first crew to leave low Earth orbit. And that's only been done 9 times in the Apollo program and never since. That they fired up the third stage of the Saturn V, which they were still attached to, in orbit. And I remember that vividly, watching the TV. It just had the audio track but from the astronauts. But just the sensation, yeah, suddenly they were leaving the Earth. They were speeding up. They had to go from 18,000 to 25,000 miles an hour and head out on a trajectory to the moon. During the way, Borman had trouble. He was sick, and they actually covered this up to some extent. He started throwing up, and he's described this vividly, and I won't go on at length, but it doesn't, you know, when you throw up in zero G, it does not go down. It floats around. And so they had a cleanup problem. He had diarrhea, and I can't even imagine that was even uglier. It appears that he was the first American astronaut to suffer really from the effects of so-called space adaptation syndrome. And it turns out now that we have much better experience and statistics, about 50% of everybody who goes into orbit feels nauseous. It's because the inner ear is disturbed by the stuff. The crystals that are in your inner ear, instead of being held down by gravity, are floating around. And so, but American spacecraft had been so cramped that they didn't have much room to float around. And Apollo was the first one that was a little larger. So they had it on the internal spacecraft tape recorder. And then at some point they had these tape recorder dumps where they dumped the data, the audio down to the ground. And they put a cryptic message to mission control, listen to the audio tape, in which they described this. By the time that NASA had a chance to react, he sort of felt better, and they wanted to delay NASA making some decision. We have to stop the mission. Now, it's hard to stop a mission going to the moon. You have to fire the big rocket engine on the spacecraft, which you see here. This is a painting from Robert McCall, which we own in our art collection, called Coming Home, which is about Apollo 8 leaving the moon. But it's that same big rocket engine you'd have to fire to stop your trajectory and come back, or to go into orbit around this moon. So this picture actually applies just as well. Going into orbit around the moon, you have to think of them going backwards and the engine firing to slow you down. So that's how they actually entered orbit as well. They entered orbit on Christmas Eve, Houston time, like at 4 a.m., Central Time, so also here, on Christmas Eve, and they were the first astronauts to see with their own eyes. We had robotic pictures now of the far side of the moon, but the first human beings to see the far side of the moon. Now, one of the most transcendent things that's come out of this, the most famous thing that come out of Apollo 8 probably, is a so-called picture called Earthrise, which has been in so many places. This was actually a somewhat accidental byproduct, and NASA released this video, and I just want to play a little piece of it because I know I'm running a little long here. But NASA just released for the 45th anniversary in December the actual internal audio tape of them taking the first picture of the Earth coming up. So it's about here.
Rising Earth moved from one window to another as Apollo 8 turns.
All right, we're going to roll. Ready?
You can look up this video audio online.
Impact crater just prior to the subsolar point on the south side, and the floor of it, nearly even because there is one dark hole.
This is actually on the internal spacecraft recorder. They're on the far side of the moon.
To see if it might be anything volcanic.
And this, they reconstructed the actual scene that they're looking at now from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, a spacecraft that's currently in orbit around the moon.
Oh my God, look at that picture over there. There's the Earth coming up. Wow, that's pretty. Hey, don't take that, it's not scheduled. Got a color film, Jim? Hand me a roll of color, quick.
Oh, man, that's great.
Where is it? Quick.
Jim, it's out here.
Just grab me a color. A color exterior.
There you go.
Got one?
Yeah, I'm looking for one. C-368.
Anything, quick.
Here.
So we've got five windows on the spacecraft.
Hey, I've got it right here.
Let me get up this way. A lot clearer.
Bill, I got a phrase that's very clear right here.
Got it?
Yep.
Let's take several of them. Here, wait a minute, let me get the right setting here. Okay, calm down, Mama. <laughs> Oh, I got it. Oh, I got a beautiful shot. 250 at F11. Okay, now there's the explosion. I did, I picked you up.
You sure we got it now?
Yeah, we'll come up again, I think.
For the astronauts, seeing the Earth rise was an unexpected and electrifying experience. And one of the three photographs taken by Bill Anders became an iconic image of the 20th century. But as we've just seen and heard, that photograph was actually a group effort. Not just because Jim Lovell found the roll of color film and gave it to Anders, but because the astronauts wouldn't have seen the Earth if Frank Borman hadn't been turning the spacecraft just as it was coming up. Today, the Earthrise has become a symbol of one of history's greatest explorations, when humans first journeyed to another world and then, looking back, saw their home planet, in Lovell's words, as a grand oasis in the vastness of space.
So that was a picture taken actually on the third or the fourth orbit. They didn't see it. They went around the moon three or four times. They went around a total 10 times before they actually saw the Earth come up because of the orientation of the spacecraft. Well, they came back very early on Christmas Day. This was a moment that was very nerve-wracking for Mission Control and others, because they the engine had to work or they would be permanently stuck in orbit around the moon and would die after a few days when the oxygen ran out. The engine worked. They came back. They came back in the atmosphere. Spectacular reentry, because they came back at night. Borman wanted to limit the number amount of time around the moon. And that meant, and they were the first astronauts then to come back at lunar return velocity, which is 25,000 miles an hour, which is so, it was much more spectacular. You know, I remember Borman and Lovell said in some movie that they said that they were jostling Anders about how scary it was, and they said it was so spectacular even we were scared. They'd been on Gemini 7 before together. Apollo 8's impact was significant, certainly in the short run. Somebody sent a telegram. I haven't tracked down the exact nature of the story, but you saved 1968. The sense of 1968 had been a terrible year, and there was an uplifting ending to it. Time replaced its cover devoted to the protester with the last minute with the Apollo 8 astronauts. The Earthrise photo, it's a lot of environmentalism has been attributed to the picture of the Earth from space. It may be a little overblown, but certainly pictures of the Earth from space did have some psychological effect on the world. And seeing then that the Earth as a planet and not just where we, you know, flat space on which we live. Though I think in the long run, Apollo 8 really became overshadowed by Apollo 11. All the emphasis was put on the moon landing, and Apollo 8 is not remembered quite as much. And I think it says a mission, because it's the first to leave low Earth orbit, the first to go into deep space, is as significant as landing on the moon. So because of time is short here, I'll just zip through this. You can see that we landed on the moon quite successfully. We made it 6 out of 7 attempts. Apollo 13, that Jim Lovell had the misfortune not being able to land on the moon. And in fact, an interesting sidelight to that is, if the oxygen tank failure that happened on Apollo 13 had happened on Apollo 8, they would have been dead, because they had no lunar module. And the Apollo 13 used the lunar module as the lifeboat to get back to the Earth. The Soviet programs failed to launch a cosmonaut. After Apollo 8, the Soviets gave up their circumlunar program, said, we can't beat that. They were just going to loop around the moon. The Americans went into orbit and everything else. They gave it up. They tried to have a lunar landing program. It never happened. And as I said at the bottom, we did it, and then we quit. In 1972, after landing on the moon, we said, we're not going to do that anymore. And it's a fact that nobody seems to absorb. I try to point this out when I can. No human has been more than 400 miles from the Earth since 1972. We are still back, and we're still in low Earth orbit, which is where we've been almost all of the space race, except for 9 Apollo expeditions. Lastly, Apollo 8 at the Smithsonian. Of course, there are 3 things from us in the 1968 exhibit, and I'd like to go up afterwards and take a little glance at that. But we have upstairs the Borman's watch, Lovell's bubble helmet, Lockheed, the Borman one here, and a flight plan from Anders. The Apollo 8 command module and Borman's spacesuit are relatively closer than Washington in Chicago at the Museum of Science and Industry. Apollo 8 astronauts did an evening lecture with us, a panel discussion for the 40th anniversary in November 2008. And I thought, if you have an hour and you're really interested in it, it's a great video. And just do a web search on that title. And finally, I just want to mention, we are hoping to have Apollo 8 as part of a new Apollo exhibit, in which I am co-curating at the Air and Space Museum, to replace the old Apollo and the Moon exhibit. And if we're lucky, and if we raise all the money we need to raise, we hope to open around the 50th anniversary in 2018-19. So thank you very much. So apologies for running a little long. I should have started on a faster track at the beginning, I guess. But if there are questions, I'd be happy to take some.
Hi, thank you for a wonderful lecture.
Thank you.
I'm curious about the relation of this legacy from Apollo. You mentioned on the last slide the number of years that no human has been in past low Earth orbit now since that time. What role do you think that the legacy of Apollo will play in future possible lunar developments in practice for deep space missions?
Well, it seems to be still inspiring a lot of people, you know, that why has 50 years gone by and we not gone there? You know, I mean, the bottom line is people don't want to spend the money. I mean, the moon hoax conspiracy theorists cite the fact that we stopped going must be evidence we never went at all. But, I mean, the fact why we stopped going was very simple. The American public said, and you can see from the opinion polls, around the end of the 60s, the beginning of the 70s, we got Vietnam, we got riots, we got poverty, we got environmental problems. We don't want to be spending money on this. And so it's generally just a lack of enthusiasm for spending that much money on NASA. But it seems to have, Apollo seems to stick in the mind for around the world. It's not just an American accomplishment. You see people around the world seem to identify with it. So I expect it will have some kind of influence. Over there, yeah.
With the Chinese picking up speed on their own lunar and otherwise space exploration, do you see a time horizon where we could be, you know, going back or going even further? Thank you.
The Chinese program, I mean, in fact, what they've accomplished so far is basically what we did 40 years ago. So in terms of human space flight and in terms of other things, but the fact that they're doing it certainly stimulates some people to, well, I think some people are hoping in the space business for a new space race, you know, that would put all the money into it. That's not going to happen. But it does raise that challenge, which might cause us to make a little greater effort. In fact, there is a Deep Space American program, which is not getting much publicity, mostly because of the influence of powerful senators from the states involved, Alabama, Florida, Utah. We have a program called Space Launch System and Orion. Orion is supposed to send a crew into lunar orbit in 2021. So we're building a deep spacecraft, but we don't have... The money is not being spent to really make a major deep space program. I mean, there are two parts to the human program of the United States, or three parts. One is that this International Space Station continues. It exists. The fact that we can only get there on Russian spacecraft is a bit of an embarrassment, and you kind of wonder at times like this, you know, whether this is going to be cast a shadow over Russian-American space cooperation is the core of the space station. That's how space station exists, is Russian-American close cooperation. But we're building, NASA's funding commercial companies to start launching crews to the International Space Station so that we'll have that kind of shuttle possibility of getting our own astronauts back up there. But going to deep space, well, the money's sort of there, but it's really kind of weak and underfunded. Obama administration is kind of somewhat reluctant. But, you know, again, you know, the space buffs want to spend billions, but the public is... Yeah, not so sure about that. Yeah. Final question.
Mine is not a question, but a statement. You mentioned the Omaha connection because off at Air Force Base back then. And that one of those connections was B. Stommer, Omaha Industrial Electric and Wire Real Works. He invented the coupler, or perhaps you'd call it the decoupler, and the take-off reel for the hoses that fed the liquid fuels to the modules.
Yeah.
And most people in Omaha don't have a clue. He also invented the process to fry Fritos.
Well, I knew there was an Omaha connection. I'm glad somebody here actually knows what it is. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Michael Neufeld, Senior Curator in the Space History Department of the National Air and Space Museum, a part of the Smithsonian Institution. The topic of his presentation was the Apollo 8 mission, as he described the drama of this historic mission that marked mankind's first journey beyond Earth's orbit in the closing days of 1968. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 13, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Patty O'Brien, former Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.